From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the judicial legacy of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
One of the few justices in the history of the Supreme Court who would have been a major figure in the history of American law, even if she had never been on the Supreme Court.
Also, what the future face of the High Court means for Michigan. Today, we talked to a former Michigan football player about Dr. Robert Anderson and the breadth of access in our state institutions for abusers.
This will go down as the most egregious, insidious molestation, rape, and abuse and cover-up in the history of sports.
And one teacher up north talks about the return of face-to-face instruction.
They're just so happy to be back here and be able to see their friends that you can see that they just want to make it work. They want to stay in school. They don't want the schools to close.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, a former University of Michigan football standout talks about coming to terms with his own interactions with Dr. Robert Anderson.
To come 30 years later to realize that how insidious this is, has all been, and the university's response, it's heartbreaking.
That's coming up in the second half of today's show, but first, the death Friday of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has thrown Michigan's public sphere into a storm of emotions. Her work prior to joining the High Court has had an impact on countless issues across this state and the United States. After her confirmation, she became known as one of the sharpest minds to serve on the court. Moreover, her passing sends what was already a highly charged election year into fifth gear. Richard Primus is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. His field is constitutional law, and he served earlier in his career as a clerk for Justice Ginsburg. Richard Primus, welcome back to Stateside.
Happy to be here.
This is, in addition to being a pivotal moment in American jurisprudence, a moment of personal loss for you. Will you tell us about Justice Ginsburg?
Sure. And thank you. It is a moment of personal loss. It's a moment of national loss, but for people who knew her and people who worked for her, as I had the privilege to do, it's also the loss of a teacher. And I appreciate your recognizing it. Justice Ginsburg was one of the few justices in the history of the Supreme Court who would have been a major figure in the history of American law, even if she had never been on the Supreme Court. There aren't many of those. I mean, most Supreme Court justices are significant figures because they were Supreme Court justices. And then there are a few who, you know, even without, there was Thurgood Marshall, and there was Louis Brandeis, and Oliver Wendell Holmes. And I could probably get to 10 names, but I couldn't get to 20.
Mm-hmm.
And she is on the short list. Because before she ever went on the bench, she was a leading figure, arguably the leading figure, in pushing forward successfully an enormous legal revolution in sex equality. It's something that is easy to take for granted after the fact, because our world is so thoroughly changed in this respect from how it was before. But if you think of the before picture, you know, what the legal world and the rest of the world around it looked like with respect to sex equality, even when she was in law school, and then think about what it looked like 30 years later, there aren't many transformations in world history to rival it. And so she arrived at the Supreme Court as someone who was already a major figure in American law. And the 27 years that she spent on the Supreme Court, of course, only add to that accomplishment.
What was unique about her legal reasoning?
It was very straightforward and simple. I don't mean simplistic, right? Mm-hmm. The old adage about, reasoning or anything else is make it as simple as possible, but not simpler than that. And she was really good at that. She could get right to the heart of what was important and pare away all the stuff that was unnecessary and briefly deliver what was important and what decided the case. And she did that. Sometimes you say that about a person because they're not also a detail-oriented person. Justice Ginsburg sweated every detail. She was incredibly hardworking and was checking everything to make sure that she was not making mistakes in any of the details. And she could see the big picture and the detail at the same time. But I think what was really distinctive about her was just how straightforward her major argumentation was.
The jaw-dropping amount of money raised over the past 72 hours, I think, speaks to the expectations that Americans have of more change on the Supreme Court in the wake of Justice Ginsburg's passage. The next term is just a couple of weeks away. A lot of people have been talking about reproductive rights and the potential for change, but are you expecting upheaval either in terms of Roe versus Wade or elsewhere?
I mean, I think it's quite likely. The Supreme Court hasn't had a majority of Democratic appointed justices since 1970, 50 years, right? There are a lot of conservatives in and out of the legal world who don't feel as if their party has controlled the Supreme Court for 50 years because there are some major issues, including abortion, where they have not gotten everything they wanted. But that's been because the Republican appointees over the past 50 years have, in some cases, been ideologically diverse. They haven't all been hardliners. And that's less and less true. That is to say, with each more recent appointment, the court moves farther and farther to the right. And this one, if the next appointment comes before a change in administration, is likely to be another significant step. There are a bunch of things that have been teetering. Roe is one of them. Another very big one is continued litigation over the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has been upheld in the Supreme Court twice, but people who want to strike down the Affordable Care Act keep coming, and they keep finding ways to try to attack the act. I don't think as a legal matter that these attacks have much merit, and so far they've been rejected in the Supreme Court each time, but they've been rejected narrowly. And if you replace Justice Ginsburg with another Trump appointee, the chances that the next attack succeeds go up. They don't go up to 100%, but they take something that we might have thought was settled, like the Affordable Care Act is with us, and they put it in jeopardy again.
If we can ask you to look at this through a microscope for a moment, the thought of some change in Roe versus Wade, while certainly not without consequence in Michigan, might be of a larger note in states that have fewer large cities and less clinical primary care. But it seems like something like a change in the Affordable Care Act could be very consequential in Michigan. Would you agree?
I think it'd be enormously consequential. I mean, the amount of our national economy that is connected to the healthcare sector is enormous, and much of it is now reconfigured around and assumes the existence of the Affordable Care Act. There are millions and millions of people across the country, including large numbers here in Michigan, who now have healthcare coverage through the Affordable Care Act, either through its Medicaid expansion or through other provisions that make insurance available to people who are not on Medicaid, including but not limited to people who couldn't be covered in the previous market due to pre-existing conditions. All of that could go away, and that would be on a human level. That would be tragic for a lot of people. You know, like the difference between having health insurance and not having health insurance is a really big difference in a person's life. And at the level of social dislocation, if you multiply that problem by millions of people, that's a very big deal also.
We should note that among the finalists that President Trump has talked about when discussing possible nominations to the Supreme Court are the names Raymond Kethledge, a Michigan native who has been shortlisted before, and Joan Larson, who's another member of the Sixth Circuit Court right now. She clerked for Justice Scalia. Do you see either of them as serious contenders given the demands of the office right now?
Well, they strike me both as people who deserve to be serious contenders on the basis of their qualifications. You know, Judge Kethledge and Judge Larson are both serious people. They're smart people. They are people who I think care about legal analysis. The president, I think any Republican president, not this particular one only, any Republican president picking a Supreme Court justice should have them on his list.
One last question. After President Trump was elected, Richard, you said that there were two major institutions that may have lost purpose in American democracy, the Electoral College, and you also named the U.S. Senate. We may again find ourselves in a place where these two institutions are at odds with what more than 50% of Americans think. How would we know if a constitutional crisis were no longer theoretical but actually here?
The first thing I should say is I do think the Electoral College and the Senate as constituted do not serve the constitutional republic well. And that's actually been my position for a long time before the election of President Trump. You can ask my students going back close to 20 years if you want to get me exercised about something, ask me to talk at length about the Senate.
They've got the notes. Okay.
Right. I believe that American constitutional democracy has been a wonderful thing. And I think it's in jeopardy for many reasons. I think that a system and an electorate that allow the present administration, which does not really believe in law or constitutionalism, to come to power is a system in jeopardy. I hope that soon we can engage broadly as a people in some serious thought about reforming some things about our democratic process. I worry very much about a situation in which a majority of the voters consistently are unable to put government in office that's responsive to them. It is not a healthy situation when a majority consistently feels, and correctly, that the rules of office holding are slanted against them. It would be a much healthier thing for our democracy if we were able to level that field and then let people make the best arguments they can about why you should vote for this guy or that guy with confidence that the system is fair.
Richard Primus, professor of law at the University of Michigan. Richard, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Next up on the show, many districts up north are open for in-person learning this fall, but it's still far from a normal school year.
It's hard to see expressions because of the masks, but you can just tell that everybody is so happy to be here.
We'll talk about some of the challenges that Michigan's more rural districts face right after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. While most school districts in the southern half of the state are operating partially or fully in virtual classrooms, a lot of schools in northern Michigan are either in person or planning to return shortly. And that includes the sizable school district of Traverse City Public Schools, which returns to in-person learning today. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston has been reporting on this, and he joins us now. Max, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the plan for Traverse City Schools?
Yeah, so starting today, they will be in-person instruction. These past 2 weeks, so the beginning of the year, they've been exclusively online. So they opened up the year with 2 weeks of virtual instruction, then jumping to in-person today. That's kind of an outlier. Most, if not all, other public schools up north have been in-person from the jump. So they're actually a couple weeks into in-person learning. Traverse City Schools are kind of the outlier.
And so how has the plan been received by parents and teachers and administrators as everything has developed?
Yeah, that's the question. I mean, it's been controversial. The school board, the 7-member school board approved this plan by a vote of 6-1, but it wasn't easy. There have been a lot of concerns about the logistics of this, how safe it is. The district is huge. There are 10,000 students. One board member in particular, Jeff Leonhardt, he's the only person that voted no. Here's what he had to say about the plan.
Is any other entity asking people to crowd into a room for 6 hours?
And so that really shows some of the divide at the administrative level. This was not an easy decision that was made. Teachers have also been worried. They've organized locally. There have been like socially distant sort of protests about this. Internal polling with Traverse City teachers showed that most of them preferred a virtual or hybrid model instead of an in-person one. Parents are also kind of split. Many have taken advantage of the online option that TCAPS is offering in lieu of the in-person instruction. So much mm-hmm. so that the district actually had to expand that program. They didn't realize how many parents would want to take advantage of it. That program has about 1,200 students in it. So this process has not been easy for the district.
So most schools in northern Michigan, as I mentioned, are returning to in-person learning. And that's very different than the situation downstate. What kind of factors can you tell us about that made up Traverse City School's mind to go with face-to-face instruction? Was it just about the case numbers?
I mean, no, it's actually a lot of stuff outside of the case numbers in the classroom. I mean, the reality is downstate, you guys know this, things like childcare, like having somewhere to, you know, take your kid if you have to work, is much easier to find downstate than it is up here. Internet access is also much less consistent up north. So if you're thinking about the options that parents have, if they aren't in-person instruction, there's fewer places to take your kid if you have to work, and your internet connection is just a little bit worse. So that makes it a little bit harder to sell virtual or hybrid learning. Also, like you mentioned, I mean, the reality is there are just less COVID-19 cases up north. Don't get me wrong, it's still affecting us, but it's much less of a sort of a factor in our day-to-day lives than it is downstate. And all the administrators I've talked to say, look, this is the risk. We're going to accept that because we think in-person learning is worth it. Here's Keith Smith. He's the superintendent of Kingsley Schools, which is in Grand Traverse County, a little ways south of Traverse City. They had a student test positive for COVID just 3 days into the school year. But I asked him, you know, is this worth it? And he mentioned the fact that the school district lost a couple students to suicide a few years ago. And he says in-person instruction really offers their students a lot and that it's worth it despite the risk. Here's what he had to say.
When you really look at the stress that students are under, certainly at home, you know, for many kids, this is their safe place. This is where, you know, they get two meals a day. When you look at the big picture, I certainly think it's best for kids to be in school. Even though they're, you know, COVID is a risk, it certainly, I think, is not the primary risk for that age group of kids.
So, Max, tell us a little bit about what you've heard about how in-person learning is going for some of the other schools up north.
Yeah, the learning itself has been relatively typical. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's still weird with socially distanced classrooms, everyone's wearing masks, there's a ton of cleaning and a ton of money being spent on that sort of thing. But as far as what this has amounted to of going back to in-person learning, really these past 3 weeks, we have seen COVID cases pop up across the whole region. Kingsley Schools, like I mentioned, Traverse City Schools, even though they aren't in person, they had a student athlete that had COVID-19. That was announced, I believe, late last week. Schools in Leland, Harbor Springs, and Cadillac have all had students or staff with confirmed COVID-19 cases. So the reality is, I mean, we're seeing the effect this is having. This wouldn't be happening, you know, if some of these students weren't in person.
Max Johnston of Interlochen Public Radio. Hey, Max, thanks for the update.
Thanks for having me.
Even farther north than Traverse City, Escanaba area public schools have already been back to in-person learning for 3 weeks now. In addition to face-to-face instruction, the district's also offering hybrid, online, and self-paced options. To check in on how all this has been going, we return to Gina Pepin, a reading specialist in Escanaba, also 2018-2019 Michigan Teacher of the Year, and someone we've talked to previously during the lockdown. Gina Pepin, welcome back to Stateside.
Hello, everyone.
So Escanaba schools, like I said, are offering a range of choices, including all online and some hybrids in addition to face-to-face. Can you remind us which variety you ended up teaching this year?
This year, I have a large majority of my own personal schedule includes face-to-face students. I do have about 9 what we consider tier 3 students that I am setting up online options for them. Some are going to actually zoom in and do kind of like a live session, and some are doing other types of things online. There's some research-based options for them. Our district, just to add to that, also offers what we call self-paced options. So in my building, we have a first grade and a second grade, and there's 7 classes for each. And there's a first grade self-paced classroom and a second grade self-paced classroom. So we have a lot of options for families. We have found, though, within the first 3 weeks now, that families have changed a lot. So they're becoming a little bit more comfortable with sending them face-to-face. So they have been a lot of changes happening.
Can I just ask you a practical question? Like, how do you keep it all straight? It sounds like you're sort of switching it out from day part to day part, maybe even hour to hour.
You know, honestly, that is very true. And we just really want we want our students to come back in any way that they can. There have been some challenges and some obstacles where folks have checked out, literally exited, and they are homeschooling, not involving a school plan that we have put out there for as an opportunity. And so we really want to try and avoid that if we can. We want them to be a part of our academic program so that we can make sure that their needs are met, you know, all of their needs, those social emotional needs and the academic needs, and just that they're okay and they're doing well.
Do you have a sense of how many of your colleagues came back, whether there was much turnover in teaching staff over the summer?
So there was a large majority of staff. There were some switch ups. One of the reasons was our particular school district closed a building. So we closed an elementary building and then merged some grade levels and did quite a lot of changing things around. In addition to that, we had a lot of retirements. We, even in my building here, out of the 14 teachers, two of them were student teachers that were in our district that didn't quite finish, in a sense, their face-to-face opportunity for student teaching. And they're now our first grade teachers, and they're doing a fabulous job. We have some, you know, great mentorship programs that will help support them. We had teachers even retiring within the week. Oh gosh, even when school started.
Well, what did those first couple of weeks feel like? I imagine it was a little chaotic.
You know, somebody said yesterday when I was talking with someone from another school district that they had a staff meeting and their administrator said to them, just, you know, great big hats off to everybody because teachers are just working tirelessly and administration is doing such an amazing job. The amount of teamwork that everyone up here is doing is just, it's goosebumps. It just really is. It's amazing. And he said, you know, it kind of feels like February. Like where we left off, February, March, and it doesn't quite feel like September. It feels like we just came back from spring break, and it's a different sense of everything. So just trying to get used to that. The kids have been phenomenal with masks. Here where we were worried first grade, second grade, like that was going to be a big obstacle, there has not been a single issue. It's just amazing how adaptable and just flexible people are.
Even among the littles?
Right. I know. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I'm honestly so proud of them. They do an amazing job. And parents have been phenomenal. All the districts up here have implemented a no visitors. No visitors. If you are picking up your child, you will pick them up outside of the building. And there are just such well-defined procedures and policies that are in place that all stakeholders have just really helped make this happen.
Tell us how school looks differently these days. I mean, obviously, kids are wearing masks, but what do you see when you walk into a classroom or a hallway?
You see a little bit of uncertainty still. You see some, you know, kids that are, they're doing the right thing to make sure that those around them are safe. And it's amazing that first and second graders can get that. They understand that. And they're just so happy to be back here and be able to see their friends, that you can see that they just want to make it work. They want to stay in school. They don't want the schools to close. And right now, I'll be honest with you, our numbers are multiplying. A local district right next door, a private school just closed today. Schools in Marquette are looking at closing. We're getting a lot of positive cases.
Mm-hmm.
Several up in Calumet Houghton area, I believe, have closed as well. Just making sure that everybody's safe. It's quieter. Again, I think just because of getting used to the new normal. At the same time, it's hard to see expressions because of the masks, but you can just tell that everybody is so happy to be here. You can just see that in their behaviors, in their body language.
Gina, there are some districts that have had problems with kids who just disappeared, you know, who either had transportation
yes.
issues or, you know, were kind of dealing with a lot of stuff in their own families in the moment. Has there been any of that in Escanaba, or have most kids shown up?
Actually, there are more than I had hoped that there were going to be. And this is a personal issue for me. It's really frustrating when we don't get return phone calls or we don't hear from those families because we worry about them. You know, we take that home. We continue to reach out and we reach out to resources in our community so that they could even perhaps knock on their door and make sure that they're okay. Folks that are choosing to homeschool or have transferred schools or we just haven't been able to get in touch with are at the top of our list every single day because we just want to make sure that they're okay.
Would you say that those are a handful or maybe numbering in the dozens?
Well, I can tell even personally, I was scheduled to meet with about 21 students at the beginning of the school year, and 9 of those students are not here.
Mm.
They're not here, and they're either they're homeschooling or with a family member, or they joined something else, or we just haven't heard from them. So they're not scheduled necessarily. We don't really know exactly. They didn't transfer to a local district. They didn't do those sort of things. So that worries me a lot.
What kind of challenges have cropped up that maybe you did not expect?
I think that piece, mm-hmm. The you know, where are they? Are they okay? There isn't a defined return plan for those kids. That's another big fear. What is it going to look like in a year from now? And what type of evidence is being collected that there's some sort of learning taking places in those scenarios in which they are right now? That's a fear. The other one is, as a staff, we were talking, the social emotional behaviors, just some kids have been pretty isolated. So if they're streaming online, and we have 2 classrooms that are streaming live a couple hours during the day. And what they've noticed, these kids, they're just not sure how to act online. Like, what do those behaviors look like? How should I act, or how can I interact with my students and my teacher when I'm the student at home logging in and trying to stream live with them? And that's just a very different kind of norm too.
What kind of academic state are you finding the kids in? Are they about where you'd expect for a normal September?
They are not. We've run a couple of screeners using some of the assessments that we use. We have not done our true benchmark yet. We're trying to work through all those kinks as well because of all of the staff changeovers, as well as like the retirements. I don't have a lot of our testing staff that are trained so that to be able to administer particular tests with validity, mm-hmm. and fidelity. So for sure. So there's some gaps there that we didn't anticipate either. And so I found that, like, our first grade, for example, a significant gap across the board in what we call phonological awareness. So not even connecting sounds to print yet, but even being able to rhyme.
Are you approaching teaching in the same way with that in mind, that there are some kids who are a little behind? Like, how are you getting your head together about what's fundamental for the kids to focus on this year?
Teachers are really just looking at the end of last year. What were those content standards, and what are the social emotional standards that are needed right now? And doing a review and just kind of gaining some observational data and some feedback even from students and families. What do we need to put at the forefront at this time? It's a lot of just building routines, building expectations, and then really getting to see where our students are social, emotionally, and academically. And that takes time. And that takes time with a great fear of getting shut down again, which really it could be in the future.
For sure. Gina, if you don't want to answer this, it's okay, but I just wanted to ask, how's your own home situation going?
Well, teach in one district, my husband's in another, and our kids go to one in between. And they are on a hybrid situation at this point because we have asthma in our family. So we've elected to do a little bit more conservative approach to it. And my 2 daughters are in high school and my son is in middle school. My daughters are totally rocking it. They're doing great. They love it. They go a couple days a week and they're still involved in sports, what's been allotted so far. My son in 6th grade is failing. He's not doing so hot. It's not a good learning environment for him at all. And so we've actually upped, you know, he was like a Tuesday, Friday student, and now he's going this week. He started, he's gone for 4 days because he begged, and his reaction to and passion to loving learning again showed when he came home yesterday. And so we have to make those adjustments again. We're one of those families where I guess we're changing things by the day too.
Gina Pepin, we really appreciate your talking to us, and hang in there. We're pulling for you and your whole family right now.
Well, thanks so much for having me again.
Gina Pepin is a reading specialist in Escanaba Schools. The school year's looking a little different for every school and family. How's it going for you? Are you face-to-face, online, or maybe completely unschooled? We're curious about what's working for you this year. Is there anything you'd like to tell parents or teachers or kids if you had the chance? We'd love to hear from you, be you a parent, a student, a teacher, or a school administrator. Leave us a voicemail, 734-764-7840. Or you can record yourself on your voice memo app and send the file to stateside@michiganradio.org. Next up, the state legislature makes another attempt at protecting and empowering victims of sexual assault. The original bills, spurred by the many victims of Larry Nassar at MSU, have received renewed energy with the case of Dr. Robert Anderson at the University of Michigan.
At the end of the day, it will come out that there could be 5,000-6,000 victims. For 30 years, there was unfettered access to athletes who had to see him.
When we come back, we'll talk with one of Dr. Anderson's alleged victims and one lawmaker hoping to change how the state helps some victims of sexual assault. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Several bills in Michigan's state legislature seek to protect and empower victims of sexual assault against public institutions that have employed sexual predators. Needless to say, this is a subject with a long and painful history in Michigan. Some similar measures failed after a great deal of work and advocacy after Dr. Larry Nassar's abuse became public. A lot of the grist for this year's debates surrounds Dr. Robert Anderson, the University of Michigan doctor who abused hundreds of young men, apparently some young women as well, during his decades in practice. With us today is John Vaughn. He's a former University of Michigan football player and also a survivor. Michigan fans will remember him well as a co-Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year in 1990. He also spent four seasons in the NFL. John Vaughn, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're also speaking today with State Representative Ryan Berman, Republican from Commerce Township, and he's working with a colleague in the legislature to sponsor two-part legislation to help victims get access to justice. Ryan Berman, good to have you as well.
Yes, thanks for having us today.
John Vaughn, we had a conversation not long ago with Justin Tinsley, the reporter from The Undefeated who profiled your journey in awakening to the fact that you were a victim of abuse. Would you tell us, in your own words, when you realized that you were part of this story?
I want to say it was March, right around March 26th. And sometime around then, I got a message from one of my best friends and teammates. And he sent me the February, I think it's February 19th article that came out in Detroit News. That's when I first heard about the story, but it probably took another week to really process the gravity of the situation in that, that I was definitely a victim.
Can you tell us about the range of emotions that were going through your mind when all these realizations came home for you?
Anger, shame, disbelief, confusion. There were so many men that you looked up to that you were realizing were a part of not only the cover-up, but instrumental in getting us as teenagers to come to Michigan. So it was just trying to discern what was real and what wasn't real, because, you know, you start to read these articles, you start to look into it. And then as you start to talk to other teammates or other players in different eras, you realize that the story is the same. Mm-hmm. And so that really hits you. And then when you look at the totality of victims, which I feel are being, you know, kind of minimized, I think that at the end of the day, it will come out that there could be 5,000-6,000 victims.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was a span of 40 years at one institution, and for 30 years, there was unfettered access to athletes who had to see him. So, you know, 2020 has been a crazy year for us all. And then on top of it, you add this and you're just like, am I living? Is this a dream? Is this, you know, one of my teammates says, do I feel like I'm watching a movie that I'm a part of?
Mm-hmm. Even when you just said back in March, I thought to myself, that sounds like 100 million years ago.
Yes.
And yet this is still a very fresh issue for a lot of the people who were involved. Ryan Berman, both Democrats and Republicans have introduced bills, in many cases bipartisan bills, about abuse. I mean, there's no question that there is some will in the legislature to address these issues. What got you interested in Dr. Anderson's story?
Well, just like you previously said of when this came out in March, and I think everything that's been happening this year and with the pandemic and coronavirus that has been dominating the headlines, and some things get pushed to the side. But as a state representative, you get, you know, in tune with many different issues and laws that affect and reach every part of our lives. And for this issue in particular, you know, it's something that when we looked at the Larry Nassar scandal, and it just kept going on, and that the victims felt like they were being re-victimized by the way the university was handling it in their response and the legal challenges they faced. I believe that this is something that we needed to come in here to do to empower these survivors to seek justice and be well aware that we have their back, you know, that they need to get these assurances that we're going to be there to support them, that people should be there to support when things come out like this.
How do you see our responsibilities to people who survived sexual abuse?
Well, I mean, even here, it's more concerning when it happened at a university, which is a part of our government, right? It's an extension of our government. And especially when it was done under the guise of medical treatment and these positions of authority. And it's just horrendous that something, and I'm here, you know, with we heard from John Vaughn being courageous enough to step forward, and there's hundreds of others, and it could be well beyond that. I mean, it's unfathomable.
Similar proposals have failed to pass in the legislature a few years ago, in no small part because of pressure from universities. Why introduce these bills now?
Well, one of the things, you know, I'm a first-term representative. We have term limits here in Michigan, and for better or not, there's positives and negatives about that. But my predecessor is Clint Kesto, Representative Kesto. He was the head of the Judiciary Committee last year, where they did a lot of these packages with the Nassar. But because of that turnover and what we saw earlier last year, we actually passed historic auto insurance reform that they've been trying to get for decades. And it finally happened with new representatives in there. So with that turnover comes new thoughts, new people, and new possibilities. And just because it's going to be a hurdle, and with any bill, there's always going to be opposition. It's, you know, somebody has to take that mantle and charge forward. And that's what I'm willing to do because it's the right thing to do.
John Vaughn, it is perhaps a little surprising that the story of Dr. Anderson's legacy of abuse did not come up during the Larry Nassar scandal and trial, given what a topic that was in its day. With most of Dr. Anderson's alleged victims being men, do you think that there's something different to the way that men view abuse or how society views and talks about sexual abuse of men and boys?
Yes. I was having this conversation with my therapist, actually, about I have a different level of empathy for survivors of abuse and never really thought of men being survivors of abuse up until March. It's just not something that we think about. And looking at how rape is minimized or trivialized, the onus is on the victim. A lot of times they're treated like the villains in these stories. And then you look at a situation like Michigan where, you know, think about, you wanted to be a Michigan man. And so whatever you needed to do to be able to play or to get on the field, you took it as this was your badge of honor. But to come 30 years later to realize that how insidious this is, has all been, and the university's response, it's heartbreaking. What I find odd is this will go down. The Michigan Anderson case will go down as the most egregious, insidious molestation, rape, and abuse and cover up in the history of sports. And yet there are so many men, so many teammates, so many other players. There's so much healing that needs to be done. It's a process. It'll probably take some of us the rest of our life. And one thing that we do know is that there are definitely times when this could have been stopped. It hasn't been. And I think that's why it's time for a bill like this to lead. And I think Michigan is trying to lead the nation, and this type of support, this type of bill, so that then we can now use this as a template for other states. And it just, we'll be able to police what obviously hasn't been policed for a number of years. And I think you cannot discuss the Anderson case without discussing the Nassar case, without discussing Ohio State, without discussing Penn State. And I think there's a case in Minnesota. That's 5 of 14 Big Ten schools.
Right.
Where is the Big Ten in this? Where is the NCAA in this? Where are the Nikes of the world? Where are the ESPNs of the world? Where are the money? Because there are armies of enablers. If you think of the institutions that protect one predator, where do we begin to shed light on we can no longer support and excuse this behavior? And thank you, Representative, that you have put this bill in place, because for us survivors, it just shows that, you know, we're not Jane Doe's and John Doe's, and we can also build our army to combat you.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are John Vaughn, former University of Michigan football player, who is among the hundreds claiming they were sexually assaulted by team doctor Robert Anderson. And we're also talking to Ryan Berman, state lawmaker from Commerce Township, who's been working on bills bolstering the rights of victims of sexual assault. John Vaughn, how has the experience of coming to this realization made you reexamine how you feel about your time at Michigan, and perhaps also how you feel about Coach Bo Schembechler?
Some of my best friends in the world are from Michigan. I will always be a Michigan man. I will always be blue. It is not changed because it's the camaraderie. It's the team. It's the games, the rivalries. That will never change. I think, you know, if Bo held me accountable for my actions, then he must be held accountable for his. And that's really, you know, I don't hate Bo. I don't hate Dr. Anderson. I'm not, you know, that takes too much energy, but wrong is right, and right is right. And so, you know, it's something that I think at the end of all of this, the strength that it takes to go from victim to survivor. I'm just proud that I'm walking into survivorhood, if you will. But I'll always love Michigan.
Ryan Berman, as we've said, these measures have come up before. What happens if once again bills facilitating some kind of change don't make it to the governor's desk?
Well, you know, it's kind of that saying, try and try again. I'm not thinking about that, but we have just a couple more months in this legislative session, and then the new one starts up in January. And the good thing about these bills, and maybe what was done in the past, is, you know, prospective looking of looking in the future. What's unique about the bills I have here is, you know, the main one is really limiting government immunity. So it's this accountability measure on the universities, and the companion bill is access to justice, which is the statute of limitation change, which is retroactive.
It lifts a 3-year statute of limitations for people abused under the guise of some kind of medical care for 1 year.
Yeah. So what it does is that it opens up this 1-year period. So whether it gets enacted and enrolled, I guess, this month, next month, or even in January, your next term, it would still open up that 1-year window for survivors to come forward, like John Vaughn. So, you know, obviously we want this passed and we want it to go through sooner rather than later. We don't want to delay justice any more than we have to. But the good thing about it is this retroactive application. So, you know, worst case, if it would have to wait until January or whatever it is, it still opens up that period. They still get to go into court.
Right. John Vaughn, Dr. Anderson has been dead for some years now, and a number of the people who enabled him have passed away as well. What do you want to see the university do to make things right?
You know, I liken it to this. Like, we were a major part of the student body, but also a major part of the marketing arm that had Michigan being one of, thought of, not just on the academic side, but one of the greatest universities on earth.
The face of the university, really.
The face of the university. And it was rhetorical, but I asked Anna Clark in an interview with her. I said, Anna, when was the last time that on Saturday at 12 noon you watched a one-hour science lab at the University of Michigan?
Right.
You didn't. You watched Michigan football. And it was that seeing Michigan football and the marketing of Michigan football that leads all of us youngsters, teenagers, to aspire to go to Michigan and get their law degree or the medical degree or whatnot. We were a prominent part of that, but now we're being forgotten. You know, they want us to stay anonymous. They want us to stay voiceless when, you know, you bled for that university. You know, you did whatever it took, endured whatever it took to be on the field. Because if you look at Bo's speech of the team, that's what it was about. The team came first. And so now it's almost as if we're being abandoned. Mm. I think Michigan has to do they have to really think about what is right and maybe even what is righteous at this point and decide for themselves how they want to be perceived in the future.
John Vaughn is a former University of Michigan student and football star. We've also been speaking with State Representative Ryan Berman, Republican representing Commerce Township. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for your time and for your work on this issue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As John just mentioned, journalist Anna Clark did a deep dive on the Dr. Anderson case for Michigan Radio. You can read it right now at michiganradio.org. That's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm April Barron. We'll see you on Tuesday.